Welcome to Local Talk on Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening in. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today, together with Paul Wearson. Hi, Paul.
Well, hi, Susan. I'll enjoy giving a preview of this year's Ragtime and Randall Festival toward the end of the show, but I understand you have a couple of unusual past events to report on.
Yes, that's right. The first event we're covering today was the Memoriam Festival for Emir Abdelkader over in the eastern Iowa town of Elkader. Even though this is beyond our listening area, we thought it was noteworthy enough that we'd like to report on it. The mayor of Elkader will tell us what it's like when a small Iowa town hosts a delegation from Algeria and why. We are speaking with Mayor Josh Pope of Elkader about the Memorial Festival of the Emir Abdelkader that was held there last week. Could you just tell us a little about it, Mayor Pope?
Well, we had a nice festival day Saturday. We had a delegation of Algerians travel from Mascara, Algeria.
This is your sister city, is that correct?
That is correct.
How did the founders of Elkader decide in 1846?
Founder, Timothy Davis, one of the founders, Timothy Davis, and John Thompson and Chester Sage, they gave Timothy Davis the option of naming the town. And he had been reading about the Emir Abdelkader and his heroism and his values and virtues through the Living Age. It was a national newspaper that was circulated. And he was such an admirer of that he decided he was going to name it after him. But knowing that the name would be a little bit of a mouthful for the New World, he shortened it to Elkader.
Was this understood by settlers back in the 19th century?
Yes, this was understood, yes.
So people were familiar with him in those days?
Yes.
Has this knowledge persisted, or has there been a fall off? That's an unusual situation. I've heard him called the George Washington of Algeria.
They considered him the founder of Algeria, and even though the French took over and was basically in charge of Algeria till 1962, when Algeria got its independence from the French, he was still the Algerians' hero through that whole time.
Well, to get back to Elkader, Iowa, and last weekend, how did you arrange to have such distinguished guests, and who were they?
When I was visiting this past July in Algeria, a group called On the Footsteps of the Emir, they're a nonprofit organization over there, just like our Elkader International Connections, they're like our sister city group. They asked if they could do an event here in Elkader, and I said that would be perfect, that I would like the Elkader International Connections to take charge of that. Then they had said that they would get some delegation from Algeria to come and to get the deputy Abdelmalek Sahari from Mascara here was a little bit of a chore, because originally they set the date for the 23rd of September, but he was still in session. And a deputy over there is like a state senator here in Iowa. So to get him to come, they had to move the date to the 30th. So we had just a little bit of time to get things going and organize, but I had a great crew here.
Is this the first time that a delegation has come from Algeria?
We've had some different visitors over the years. The past ambassador of Algeria here in the United States has been here. The ambassador this year would have been coming, but he was busy at the UN General Assembly in New York at this time, so it didn't work for him to come. There has been several different delegations here over the years.
You mentioned that it was a delegation, not just the leader from Mascara.
Correct. We also had a teacher that was the interpreter at the time in 1984 when our mayor, Ed Olson, had went to sign the agreement. She also came. We had the project manager for On the Footsteps of the Emir, the mother and two brothers of the deputy Abdelmalek Zahari. Then we had the deputy's nephew that attends Iowa State University.
It sounds like there is a lot of interest on the Algerian side. How do you hold that up on the American side?
When Mayor Ed Olson was involved in the, and we first started, there was a lot of interest. And over the years, it's kind of slacked a little bit on our part. In 2008, after we had our major flood and lost several homes, the country of Algeria sent us a substantial amount of money to help with the devastation of the flood. That's when the co-founder and CEO of the Abdelkader Education Project, Kathy Garms, kind of took charge of everything and really started bringing back that connection. And then that's been since 2008. And then when I became mayor 2 years ago, I was invited over there last September, and I committed to reviving and strengthening our relationship through culture, agriculture, education, and that's what we're continuing to do. And then as we grow again and the Al-Qaeda International Connections has more closeness tie with On the Footsteps of the Emir, I think it's going to be a great connection.
After Mayor Pope's description of the past and the events leading up to last Saturday's festival, we heard more personal stories from Sharon Sini, who works with him through the Abdelkader Education Project.
Hello, Susan.
Well, hi, Sharon. I just wanted to hear your impression of the weekend. Your responsibilities were quite a bit different than Mayor Pope's.
Right. I was, for one thing, trying to coordinate the food. Our Algerian guests, after they got here the end of last week, spent a lot of hours cooking food, and so that we could have some traditional Algerian food. And that included lamb with vegetables, couscous to go with the lamb, and then a sweet couscous for dessert. That's a primary food there. To make it into a dessert, they just add raisins and nuts and pour honey over it. So those were the things that they prepared, and Mayor Pope also cooked some chicken kebabs that went well with the food.
You said your guests prepared this. I thought there was an Algerian restaurant in Al-Qaeda.
There is a restaurant that serves some Algerian food, but they were not involved in this particular meal. They actually prepared it at a restaurant called Fennelly's, an Irish pub.
Well, it is a real international collaboration.
Yes, it is. We've had a lot of visitors from Algeria over the years, including ambassadors. There was an exchange in 1987 where a group of adults from Al-Qaeda went to Algeria, and then a group of high school students also went to Algeria. And that, up until now, was probably the high point of our connection. We are hoping to have an exchange through the school, possibly a Skype, you know, sort of a modern-day pen pal situation, classroom interactions between a classroom in Algeria and a classroom in Al-Qaeda. We have ongoing efforts to educate people about our history. Algerian people who just come here unannounced, because if they come to the U.S., they tend to all know about Al-Qaeda and the fact that it is named after the emir. As Mayor Pope says, everybody in Algeria knows about Al-Qaeda. When we had a recent reception here, there was a girl, a college student from Atlanta, Georgia, who's of Algerian descent, who just came to the Abdelkader Education Forum and then to Al-Qaeda just because she had read about Al-Qaeda and was interested. I ran into some people at the grocery store from Algeria who just came to see what Al-Qaeda was like.
How many people were there on Saturday?
We had a large tent and all our tables were full.
So you actually held your ceremonies in a tent in the park. Yes.
Al-Qaeda, which is the former flood zone where there used to be houses. And it's a popular place for events in Al-Qaeda. There is a small playground in Al-Qaeda that is named after the son of the former Algerian ambassador. His 2-year-old son unfortunately died, and Idris Jazari is his name, and he gave money for a park, some playground equipment here in Al-Qaeda in memory of his son. We do now have here the teacher who was the translator during the 1987 exchange. She has come into the room.
Oh, wonderful.
Since we started. Would you like to talk to her?
Of course I would.
Hello?
Hello. Would you please introduce yourself? And I understand you were here in Al-Qaeda in 1987 as a translator?
Not in Al-Qaeda, in Algeria, in Mascara, when a delegation visited Mascara. I was the translator for all the people there who came from Al-Qaeda to Mascara.
But is this your first visit to Al-Qaeda, Iowa?
Yes, it is my first visit.
Had you been in the United States before?
No, it is the first time.
The first time,
I hope it won't be last.
What was your impression of the festival? I understand you probably did some cooking, too, to help along.
Yeah, I prepared the national dish, which is called couscous, with meat and vegetables.
You prepared it for everybody?
I prepared it with two other girls. We prepared it for all our guests here in Al-Qaeda for the festival event.
That sounds like a very... huge contribution, as well as, of course, I imagine that they needed your skills as a translator.
I am eager to collaborate, either in cooking, in translating, in taking photos, many things.
What was your most vivid impression of Al-Qaeda and the weekend?
What I liked is the surroundings, nature, climate. The people are like nature, are natural. I like them very, very much. They are very generous. They are grateful. They are really nice people. Like our nature here in Al-Qaeda, the nature, the green all around.
I imagine that is a little bit different than Mascara. Is that right? Is Mascara in the desert?
No, not a desert.
No.
Mascara is an agriculture town, too. The difference is that you use wood for buildings, but we don't use wood rarely. Rarely wood is used for buildings. So this is the difference. We have farms, we have trees, we have fruitful trees like olives, like we have grapes, we have apples, we have many, many. It is an agricultural town.
Oh, really? Then that is like Al-Qaeda, Iowa.
Nearly, because you have a lot of green, but we don't have this. We have mountains, we have valleys, we have animals like cow and sheep. We have cows and sheep in our town. And many, many, many Mascarians, people from Mascara, are farmers. Even if they are doctors, they are teachers or businessmen, or they have farms, they are farmers at the same time. They work in offices like teachers, like directors, like managers, like doctors or anything. But at the same time, they are farmers.
They actually go to the farms, live on the farms?
Yeah. But because their farms is not very far from the center town. For example, in my family, my father used to be a farmer. He used to be a farmer and a teacher at the same time. My brother is an officer, and he has got a farm. His children are studying, are teaching, and they follow their father. They work with their father in the farm.
I think that is the way it used to be in Iowa. Not so much anymore. Although often people work in town and still have farms. But we don't have, our farms are much larger than they used to be. How large are your farms?
Not very large, because they are personal. I mean, it depends on the family. Some families are rich, so the property is larger. Others, no. So they have got small smaller farms. It depends on the family. It depends on many things. Mostly everybody in Mascara, not all, I see in general, they have got a farm outside the town. For example, our farms, we have got a farm. It is 10 kilometers out of the center. That's all. We used to go on foot there. We walked there with my father, with my mother. I personally used to go on foot to the farm. We spend especially the weekends, the holidays there. But father used to go every day there, every day. Even sometimes he spent the night. When it used to rain, he has to irrigate the land. So he spent the night there to irrigate. When a cow was going to have her calf, he used to spend the night with them to take care of them.
This is a wonderful picture of Mascara for our listeners. I thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure for me to talk about Alcader and Mascara at the same time.
Thank you, Jamila. This is KHOI Community Radio, and you've just heard a description of life in Mascara, Algeria, from Jamila Ben-Kadour, translator and major participant in last Saturday's Memorial Festival for Amir Aboulkader. Are there any closing statements you'd like to make, Mayor Pope?
The population of Mascara is almost 800,000. Compared to Alcader of 1,273, that's quite a bit bigger.
Quite a bit bigger. Before we close this topic, I'd like to play Alcader Mayor Josh Pope telling us of his vision for Iowa. Underneath his remarks, you will also hear a traditional Algerian song entitled Aboulkader.
This is very important, not just for Algeria and Alcader, but for the state of Iowa and the U.S. The vision I have is that they want to not only have a sister city with Alcader and Mascara, but be a sister state with Iowa and Algeria. And I have committed to help them obtain that. Of course, it's quite a lengthy process to do, and I have visited with sister state. They were here on Saturday also. And spoke about the relationship, and I've also spoke with the Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg in person with the possibilities, and everybody seems to be very open about the possibilities.
This is KHOI Community Radio saying goodbye to Alcader and the window to Algeria it has opened for us. Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, are your hosts for today. Next up is a road trip to Tiny Fest Midwest.
Well, now that should be a change of pace. This was a real road trip to the Jasper County Fairgrounds.
Yes, that's right. Maggie Westfold and I will take you on a road trip with our intern videographer, Aaron O'Neill, to Jasper County for Tiny Fest Midwest. This is a follow-up to Maggie's interview on Local Talk a couple of weeks ago with Renee McLaughlin, organizer of the festival. And you can see Aaron's video of the trip on our website. This is a first for KHOI, so we're very excited about this. And that took place the afternoon of Friday, September 29th. It was a beautiful day, and we had plenty to talk about as we drove along. We recorded some of that, but I'll play only 3 minutes to introduce Aaron and give you a feeling of the conversation. Thanks, Maggie, for picking us up. We're here with Aaron O'Neill, our new intern, who's got a really interesting project. And this really is a road trip that was inspired by a program you did with Renee McLaughlin, who is the organizer of a Tiny House and Simple Living Conference at the Jasper County Fairgrounds. Although she told us a lot, I kept wondering, what's the simple living part, and what do these tiny houses look like? And Aaron came to the rescue with his willingness to videotape that. Aaron, do you want to tell us what you're going to do?
I'll be taking video, getting some interviews of people living in their tiny homes. Just get their perspective, and we'll be able to take that video and put it up on YouTube, and they'll be featured on the KHOI site.
Well, that's a first for us. Maggie, this is your first road trip.
It is. I'm excited to do a road trip. I've heard you talk about road trips with Paul for the past many years, and I'm looking forward to this. The program with Renee was a lot of fun, and she gave us a lot of great information on that segment, just enough to really pique my interest, so I'm looking forward to this.
Well, I'm excited to go along, and actually, you had originally said you were a little leery of a video trip because you didn't want to be seen interviewing people, and I wanted to reassure you that I'm along to hold the mic, and we can just stand behind Aaron most of the time.
That makes me happy, Susan. Thank you very much.
The questions that came out of the program that you did before were, what is the simple living part? I mean, Renee explained that she lived in an 87-square-foot tiny house, and she even described some of the way it must have looked and functioned, but not very many people would actually live in a space like that. I'm familiar with tiny houses. I didn't realize it was a tiny house, but when I showed my husband Fritz the book about tiny houses, he said, well, those are bigger than our boat that we live on for 2 or 3 months a year, our sailboat. We certainly became aware from living on that, especially when we were on a mooring and we had to have enough water in our 100-gallon tanks to see us through several days.
We needed to keep our 100-amp-hour battery charged in case we had to start our engine.
We also, being from the Great Lakes, where they have strict regulations against dumping blackwater overboard, we had 50-gallon blackwater holding tank, but we had to go and find someplace to not dump it, but to have it pumped out. So all these things made me realize that, you know, how we live, how much we use when we are in our other 9 months or 10 months out of the year, compared to how little we can get by with on a boat. But, of course, that isn't simple living because in addition to our boat, we also have an apartment now, used to be a house. What classifies as a tiny house?
Well, I'm curious to hear the answers from the people who know, but
turn left onto State Highway 245.
That was our GPS.
Well, yeah, I could hear your GPS voice giving you directions.
Right. Well, that's to prove we really recorded this in a car on our way. We really needed that guidance because we were talking so much that we missed our turn. But anyway, but when we got there, we were fortunate that we had plenty of time because we'd chosen to go down to the event while they were setting it up. And right away, I found Jay Schaefer, the founder of the Tiny House Movement, so that we could interview him as soon as we got there. Aaron got a picture of him as I was interviewing him in Maggie's car, which you can see on his YouTube. So, but here's more of that interview.
I actually was an art student. I wanted to go to architecture school in Ames, but I couldn't quite afford it, so I got a scholarship in painting and drawing at the University of Iowa.
Now, your tiny house is based on, I believe, American Gothic. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know how direct the reference is, but there is a direct-ish reference in there because I was aware of American Gothic and I was looking for the quintessential Midwestern home, and there's no better example that looks good anyway, as far as I'm concerned, as that house that's between the two people in American Gothic painting.
Do you have that house here with you?
I don't. I sold that first house that I built about 10 years ago, and I've lived in 3 tiny houses since then. So I've gone through about 4 tiny houses by now. I go smaller and smaller, it seems.
that was one of the things that intrigued me about Maggie's discussion with Renee, was the tinier houses and what is it that makes it possible to actually seek out tinier spaces?
Well, I think when I look at it, it seems like the words sustainable or green really just mean efficiency. I guess at this point, it's just everything's sustainable and green because it's a great marketing tool. But before that, it was all about efficiency. And I think that there is a drive, like an inherent drive, just sort of a natural part of us that is just like the rest of nature, which is very efficient. So striving for that in design and in living is, I think, pretty natural.
I think many people couldn't imagine living in a house that's much smaller than where they live now. Do you feel that living in a tiny house changes you, or you have to be prepared for that in some other way?
I think it's both. It changes you. I guess it's the art-life thing. I think that a lot of people who imagine they couldn't live in a small house, a tiny house, probably could, and for that matter, there's no reason to really define it in a very concrete way. I always just say a tiny house is any house in which all the space is being used for the occupants, you know, happy survival.
Well, okay, we got a glimpse of what Jay Schaefer thinks of the tiny house movement. What did you see at the festival?
We saw some pretty neat houses. Aaron got pictures of several while I was interviewing the people at their houses. I think you could sum up the houses we saw as innovative. I'll talk with Renee again about her impressions of the whole Tiny Fest Midwest. But before I do, I'd like to play my conversations with the owners of a couple of the most unusual houses. The first was a small turquoise and white trailer with a palm tree and flower-decorated crib that said Aloha. There were three young children running around. These were the only children who we saw at during the setup. And I asked their mother what the story of their house was.
I was born and raised in Iowa, and the military sent us over to Oahu for 3 years. So we got to live the island life and enjoy that. And I feel that Iowa needs some of that island life, so I brought it back with us.
And the military transported your trailer?
No, I redid this here in Iowa when I got back. Needed something for my business.
What's your business?
I sew children's clothes.
I had been wondering if tiny houses could be used to shelter victims of hurricanes or other disasters. My question was answered by a man at a round building that looked like a grain bin with windows and a door.
I'm Paul Van Gorkum, and I'm the executive director of a faith-based nonprofit called Go Serve Global. And we have a safety home here. This is a converted 18-foot grain bin that was designed by Sukup Manufacturing, the same company that makes the grain bins. And this home is made in the exact same plant as the regular grain bins. But what we do with it is we purchase these from Sukup, and then our organization takes them overseas to third world countries to provide housing for people that have been victims of disasters.
So do you expect that you're going to be going to the Caribbean islands pretty soon?
Well, we have about 250 of these homes already in Haiti. And if we can get some good connection to some of the other islands that were really hit twice with these last two hurricanes, then we would be more than happy to go there as well. Last October, Hurricane Matthew went through southwest part of Haiti, and right where we had almost 200 of these homes. And we had 145-mile-an-hour winds, and every single one of our safety homes survived that hurricane. So we were really pleased with that. 90% of other homes right around us were either totally destroyed or badly damaged. So we were real happy with this. In fact, we had as many as 60 people coming to these safety homes after their own homes were destroyed to seek shelter from that hurricane.
We had to leave the Tiny Fest Midwest site shortly before it opened, so I was curious to know what happened later. I knew there was going to be a lot of live music and some speakers, but I wanted to know how many people showed up and why they were interested. So I called Renee McLaughlin this week to find out. when we saw you last was just as you were setting up for the Tiny Fest at the Jasper County Fairgrounds. Almost 2 weeks later, you're just taking down the last of it. Is that right?
Yes, I'm just waiting for a few folks to come and pick up their houses.
When we were there, there were probably only 10 or 12 houses up, and you were about to start at 5 o'clock. What happened in the next few hours?
Sure. The hours that led up to our 5 p.m. start time were a steady flow of houses streaming in. We ended up with over 20 of them, I think close to 25 structures altogether for people to tour throughout the weekend.
And how many people came?
We believe there were over 4,000 people that came throughout the weekend, quite a bulk of them on Saturday. That was a very busy day on Saturday for folks to see the homes and enjoy the festival.
One of the things that we discussed as we were coming down to the Tiny Fest was just what is this about? There's something different about the tiny house movement.
Yes, it really is a unique movement for sure.
What was it that you as an organization at Tiny Fest were promoting?
For the Tiny Fest, was really promoting the lifestyle and values and beliefs that generally go right along with the tiny house movement, which include spending more time focusing on people and less on items, controlling your life a little bit more in a way that is a positive reflection for you. So that may be more financial freedom. It may mean less of environmental impact. It may mean more freedom overall as far as not being tied to a 9-to-5 job. A lot of the folks that were at Tiny Fest are ones that have sort of an income that allows them to be more mobile. There are a lot of tiny houses out there that folks live in, and they work Monday through Friday type job, no matter what the hours are. They're pretty steady with their homes. Those folks were here, a lot of them, having great conversations, but they didn't bring their home. You know, just because it's on wheels doesn't mean that it's very quick and easy to just pick it up and move it, you know? So bless the folks that did bring their homes to share with others that have kind of a very mobile lifestyle. They were able to bring some great messages with them to share with the folks that came to Tiny Fest Midwest. I think one more facet that comes along with the tiny house movement is the skills and the confidence and the ability to learn something new and build something yourself. You know, a lot of folks that were here had built their own tiny house. It may have been their first build ever, and some of them had learned some skills when they were a child, but there was kind of a self-reliance there. A lot of them use solar power, so they're, again, being self-reliant and self-sustaining. When you can really take great care of yourself in a way that makes you happy, then you're able to take care of others and build others in those same ways, you know, building self-esteem and confidence and skills and neighbor helping neighbor.
And I would imagine you'd have a lot of those individual solutions that fit one person but wouldn't fit anybody else.
Tiny houses are very customized. You know, generally the owner has a good grasp on, you know, what is most important to them, and they've kind of peeled away all of the extra stuff. And of course, as individual as we all are, we have different needs, desires, and when you kind of peel away all the general stuff, you find that those interests and desires are all very unique.
How would you sum up the weekend?
It was an amazing weekend. I felt I was so excited to make so many people happy. I mean, folks were just so glad to be able to connect with other tiny house owners and builders. They had been so interested and felt you just don't know who else is out there that might have those similar interests until something like this brings us all together. So that was just a great experience. I had a gal that just learned that her cancer was going into remission. And she said, you know, I think I'm going to buy a tiny house this weekend. She said, I feel like a kid in a candy store when I go in these. I'm I'm excited and giddy and happy, and that's how I want to spend the precious days and years that I have left. So she had narrowed it down to three and actually didn't end up getting a house here, but it's still in her plans to get one soon. But it was really neat to be able to see her and others enjoying the festivities.
Thank you. We've been talking to Renee McLaughlin, who organized the Tiny Fest in Jasper County Fairgrounds. This is KHOI Community Radio, and your hosts, Paul Wearson and I, are devoting this program to festivals in central Iowa. The upcoming festival is Ragtime in Randall, celebrating its 31st year.
Yes, that's true. It's coming up this weekend, October 7th at Randall, Iowa. And I hope we have Don Brecky on the line here. Don, are you there?
I am here.
Well, Don, it's good to talk to you. And we're coming up on Saturday. It's the 31st annual Ragtime in Randall Festival. And you might tell the folks a little background about how this began in a town of 170.
Actually, back in the mid-80s, a fellow by the name of Bob McNutt, who had a piano tuning business in Clarion, he just happened to come across the town of Randall. Now, I have a feeling that he was probably down tuning pianos, and then that's how he came across Randall. Well, he fell in love with the town, and he ended up buying a home in Randall, an old Victorian home, which he restored it, and he filled it with grand pianos. In fact, on our website, which is ragtimeandrandall.com, not .org, but ragtimeandrandall.com, there's a picture of this living room with the employees that he had. I think he had around five employees, and it's quite a good picture. And that's how it began.
How did it evolve into the festival this size, Don?
Well, what he did, he started hosting a few concerts in his house, which was an attraction of its own, and then various houses in the community, and then it did grow. Oh, he also had a few pianos on rollers. And he would roll them around town. And then it got so big that he moved it to the gymnasium. We have a gymnasium in Randall that was built in 1950, and it's been kept in just terrific condition and restored, and that looks great. And then it's gone from the gymnasium back and forth to the local Lutheran church, which is Elam Lutheran Church. They have a permanent sound system there that works really well for Ragtime and Randall.
And so for all these years, we've had ragtime artists come in from all over the country, and you might highlight what's going on this weekend. We have Brian Keenan. He's a composer and performer of ragtime music, and Rod Byenson. He's a local guy from Nevada. He plays ragtime, and he's participated in all kinds of festivals, and actually, we have a headliner, too. Daniel Savigny from Hampshire, Illinois. He's a 17-year-old improvisational ragtime piano player. He began at age 10. He's going to be a guest here in a few minutes. So you might tell us a little bit about those guys and what they're going to do this weekend, Don.
Okay. Well, Rod, I've known him the longest. He used to play a steady job in the Ames area at the local Shakey's Pizza. So he is actually quite well known throughout the Story County and actually mid-Iowa area. And he also has his wife plays with him occasionally, and she plays a flute. And so they make a good combination of ragtime music. A fellow who's been coming down here anywhere from, I'd say, 8 to 10 years, Brian Keenan, he has played down in the ragtime, Scott Joplin ragtime down in Sedalia, Missouri, which is the cradle of ragtime. Now, we have gotten at least a half a dozen performers out of that performing area. And like you say, they have come from all over the United States, actually, to come into Randall to play. And so that's Brian. He's a very good player, young fellow, graduated from college out in the University of Colorado in music. And then Daniel Savigny, I've seen him when he was actually probably 11 or 12 years old playing down at the Scott Joplin Ragtime Festival. And I thought, my, this boy is good. Well, now he's developed into a young man, and he's won contests in Illinois. And I heard him at a concert about a month ago. He came into Ames. Somebody had hired him to come into Ames. And I was just astonished. And one of the other people on our crew that look for music, people like that, we hired him on the spot. He's fantastic. When you come to hear him, everybody else is terrific as well. But he is sensational, and he's just basically starting his career.
So at Ragtime in Randall this weekend, just picture this. It's right on the interstate. In fact, if you go north on Highway 35, you're going to get to the Story City exit. The very next exit north of that is the Randall exit, and you go west, and you go into this beautiful little town of 170 people, marked by one skyscraper, which is a giant grain elevator. And you're going to go to the Elam Lutheran Church there in town, which has excellent acoustics. And it's going to be 2 o'clock in the afternoon this Saturday until 7:30 p.m., and there's a break for lunch from 4 to 5:30 at the Lutheran Church, served by, and get this, church ladies. Well, can you get better food than with church ladies? So
that's terrific. I might add that that exit number is 128.
Right, Randall exit 128.
Yeah, and, Randall exit 128.
If you're coming up from Ames, it's easy to find that, easy to get to Randall. And I guarantee you won't be lost in Randall. If you go right into town, the church is right on your left. And it's going to be Ragtime in Randall, 2 o'clock this Saturday.
And another thing, and then I'll be quiet for a bit, there's no charge. There's no charge for the lunch. There's no charge for the performance.
Everybody out there, Ragtime in Randall this Saturday, October 7th. It'll be 2 p.m. until 7:30 at the Elam Lutheran Church in Randall. Lunch about 4 to 5:30, all kinds of Ragtime in Randall. Great Ragtime music and piano playing from Daniel Savigny, Brian Keenan, and Rod Beinson. And thank you, Don. We'll see you at Randall.
Absolutely. I'll look for everybody there. Thank you.
Very good. Now, Susan, Ragtime is a very rare kind of music these days. It's an interesting syncopation, and not every piano player can do Ragtime. You have your left hand and right hand doing all kinds of things that I, as a non-piano player, can't understand. And the big festival is the Scott Joplin Festival in Missouri, held annually. Scott Joplin is one of the number one composers of ragtime music. So that Ragtime Festival is the big festival in America. And basically, you're talking about a situation where we have those people coming to small town Ragtime, Randall, this coming weekend, Saturday, 2 to 7:30 p.m. right here in central Iowa in Randall. And we have someone on the line here. We've got Daniel Savigny in Illinois. Daniel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
And Daniel, you've been performing since what? Age what? When did you start?
I started performing around age 8.
And so you were a gifted pianist, and I'll brag a little. My brother was a piano player who could play by ear at age 3. And he became a vocal and music instructor and later a Methodist minister. But he had this gift that I couldn't fathom. You must have that same gift.
Well, to an extent. When I was 8, I wasn't quite an amazing pianist, but I was able to do things by ear that a lot of other pianists my age couldn't. Although sight reading, I've never been able to sight read.
Really? Now, how did you get into ragtime music? When did that happen?
I was about 8 years old or so, and one of my beginning piano books had the Maple Leaf Rag by Scott Joplin in it. And it was a pretty easy and, you know, boring arrangement of it. But apparently it was enough to get me hooked, and after that I had been bitten by the ragtime bug.
Now, ragtime, you might talk about how that differs from other kinds of music.
Ragtime is a very unique style of music. There's nothing really out there that's quite like it because, I mean, the closest thing you could probably identify it to is a march. And the difference between a march and a rag is that on a march, everything is on the beat. But with ragtime, everything is off the beat, it's syncopated, and that causes it to have that almost dance-like feel, because ragtime, after all, is a style that you would dance to.
Now, the Scott Joplin Festival in Missouri, mm-hmm. you've actually entertained there. How old were you then when you went to the festival?
First year I went to the Scott Joplin Festival, I was 12 years old.
And that's like playing on Broadway. That's a big festival down
in
there.
In the ragtime world, it is.
Yes, it certainly is. In the ragtime world, Scott Joplin's number one, not only in composing ragtime, but also the famous Scott Joplin Festival. And you were there at that age. Was that intimidating?
The first year, to an extent, yes, it was, because a lot of my idols were there, you know, a lot of pianists that I've always looked up to, and it was amazing to be able to meet people. And some of them even have connections almost all the way back to Scott Joplin.
Now, ragtime music was really in fashion in the late 19th and early 20th century, mm-hmm. and often seen as very suggestive. You know, every generation rues the things that their kids like musically. In the 50s, when I was coming up, it was Elvis Presley and rock music, presumably. In the 30s and 20s, it was big band music. And I think probably at the turn of the century, parents feared that ragtime would lead their children astray. And so...
No, to be honest, it's the same thing as, you know, hip-hop and rap nowadays. It's the same... I'm not comparing the two. I'm just saying it's the same sort of situation where parents are, you know, worried about how the music is going to affect their kids. And, you know, back then, ragtime was played in a lot of suggestive places around certain neighborhoods. And that's sort of how it got a bad rap.
You mean brothels,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. Red light districts.
Yeah.
And now ragtime is, well, I suppose for a lot of people, it's obscure. You have to know something about not only history and the era where it was popular, but also you have to have some appreciation for a wide variety of music.
That's true, you know.
And for the time this coming weekend in Randall, and I hope you can find us. Just come off the interstate. We're there. Don't be late.
Yes, please don't be late.
Randall is not a big thing on the map, but it's a big thing in ragtime. And this is our 31st annual festival in Randall. And you'll be playing along with Brian Keenan and Rod Bynson. And you've probably known Brian Keenan from earlier festivals where you played. Is that right, Daniel?
I honestly can't say that we've met before.
Well, that's going to be exciting. You get to meet him this weekend.
Yeah.
You'll find a lot in common with him mm-hmm. because he began at age 10 and has been playing ragtime all this time. So there must be, I expect, a great communal feeling between you two because your experiences are so similar. And I think that it's going to be exciting to hear you play and also Brian. And you'll enjoy Rod Bynson, too. He's a great piano player and a great personality. And you're going to enjoy playing at the Elam Lutheran Church because the acoustics are very good up there. And so you're going to have fun performing.
I'm sure I will.
You're going to have fun relating to the other piano players who with whom you'll have so much in common. And guess what? Daniel, you get to eat food prepared by church ladies.
Oh, I love food.
Yeah. Well, you're really going to love church lady food. There's even a play about Lutheran church ladies that's toured the country. It's called Church Basement Ladies, and it's funny. And actually, German chocolate cake. Sandwiches. I think there's going to be some kind of hot roast beef. I'm getting hungry just thinking about this festival coming up.
Me too.
And I hope to see you there too. I'll be there along with Don Brecky and all the people who are working with the committee to bring this off every year. Keep in mind, Daniel, it's our 31st annual, so you're following a lot of great piano players, and you're going to really top our bill. You realize you're the headliner this weekend. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Well, the pressure's on, Daniel. I'm sure you've been in bigger venues and more challenging places, but this weekend, Daniel Savigny will be in Randall, Iowa for the 31st annual Ragtime and Randall show, along with Brian Keenan and Rod Byenson. And so, Daniel, you live in Illinois, is that right?
That is correct.
And you're in a small town?
Pretty small town. It's called Hampshire. It's sort of right in the middle between Rockford and Chicago. It's a nice little town, but ragtime isn't a very prominent art here. In fact, I've never played a show in my own town.
Very good. Well, Daniel, you're going to be in a much smaller town, and it's Randall, Iowa, population 170. So, Daniel Savigny, coming to perform at Ragtime and Randall this weekend, Saturday, October 7th, from 2 to 7:30. Daniel, see you in Randall this weekend.
See you then.
And we have a little ragtime music to finish the show with, and it's from Brian Keenan from his CD, Hidden Falls. So, Colorado Panorama, and it's a different kind of ragtime. It is... the beat's the same, but the tempo is much slower than the traditional. Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today, together with Paul Wearson, bringing you guests from three festivals, from the Memoriam Festival for Emir Abdelkader. Our guests were Mayor Josh Pope, Sharon Sini, and Jamila Ben-Kadour. From Tiny Fest Midwest, we heard from Maggie Westfold, Erin O'Neill, Jay Schaefer, Paul Van Gorkum, and Renee McLaughlin. From Ragtime and Randall, Don Brecky and Daniel Savigny.
Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1. Also, remember that you can hear us online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Today's show was engineered by Rebecca Reuter. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Abdelkader by Algerian musicians and Colorado Panorama by Ragtime and Randall performer Brian Keenan from his CD, Hidden Falls.
Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Let us know what you think. You can call us at 515-292-2878. Email us at khoiradio@gmail.com or go to the contact page of our website, khoifm.org. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and
we'll see you again on the radio.
Support for KHOI comes from Mary Greeley Medical Center, providing inpatient and outpatient services on a continuum of care. Located at 1111 Duff Avenue in Ames. Find out more information at www.mgmc.org. That's mgmc.org.
It's Delaney. This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City, Ames, and surrounding areas.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack. Because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives.
As the death toll in Puerto Rico rises to at least 34,